Hey there, Paisani. Welcome back to another episode of the Italian-American Podcast and Buona Natale, because this is our final broadcast before the Christmas holiday arrives, and I am sure everybody
That's inaccurate.
Why?
Because we cannot go with the mindset that Christmas ends on December 25th.
Oh, my goodness.
I have scheduled Christmas episodes all the way to January 6th. And if I was in the mood, I'd keep going to February 2nd.
But the holiday will have passed by the time we come back.
The octave of Christmas goes to January 1st. And if you want to take Christmas as a liturgical season, at least to January 6th, possibly with an additional octave to the 13th, which is the vigil of my birthday.
Of course.
Have a vigil of its own. And then in medieval times, like in the Tudor times, it would have gone on to February 2nd.
Why February 2nd?
The presentation. That's Candlemas. Candelora.
Oh, yeah. Well, for all of us measuring our time in octaves, as Pat points out, then this is not the last broadcast before Christmas.
We should all measure our time in octaves.
We sure should.
Novena's an octave. Does that make me an octavian? I'm an octavian. That sounds like a very British thing, octavian.
It does sound like you're part of a private club.
my London club, the Octavians.
We should start that. That should be the new name.
I have to go to London to the club Octavian. They have reciprocity that we'd find like an American club.
Yeah, I know. That we need that more stuff like that.
With the Metropolitan, I have reciprocity with the Octavians.
Yeah, with the Octavians. But it will be Christmas after this.
Why do people listen to this?
I don't know.
I want to apologize.
Get yourself a head examination for the Christmas.
There's so many good things you could do in your life, but
you know why they come? Because of topics like we're going to talk about today. Because of things like Struffoli and the traditions that we keep that people. You just can't seem to get away from. I feel like.
Are you taking off your Sicilian hat today? Are you going to be like a Neapolitan again?
Are you telling me the Sicilians can't eat Struffoli? Is that what you're saying?
No, they have a different. They call it pignolata.
Well,
and they make make it for St. Joseph's. They can't make it for Christmas, and they'd be just like us.
Who would want to be like just like the Neapolitans? No, I have a Neapolitan side. My grandmother made Struffoli. This is a big deal.
Sure, but it comes on and off. You're Sicilian every day. You're Neapolitan when it's convenient.
You know, and I used to be much more Neapolitan.
People don't understand what happened.
If I had been so avowedly Sicilian when we met, would we be friends? Did I need to be so Neapolitan back then? Is that what happened?
I'm going to save you from yourself because you've gone off the Sicilian deep end. And they think this is shtick, but I've seen
No, it's true.
I don't know. We were in Argenio's store and then your life just made a 180 degree turn.
Mrs. Argenio just pointed out that as much as I love Naples, I was just Sicilian masquerading as a Neapolitan.
You are Sicilian masquerading. Because you're going to be saying it's pignolata and some other word, chicharata.
I won't turn on my Neapolitan side. I mean,
but today, for one day, as they say in Abidjan, for one day a year.
Yeah, for one day a year. On Christmas Eve, I don't know, I guess the traditions that I have in my family, those are from my dad's side, from Campania.
Neapolitans are more, I think Christmas Eve is I don't want to say it's a Neapolitan holiday, then everybody's going to go to, but it's because the fact you had fast and abstinence on December 24th and the coast, the Amalfi coast, the Sorrento coast, all the way up to Gaeta, the port of Naples, we had a lot of access to fish. We just ran with it.
Yeah.
Because I say this to people all the time. I wish Ro was on this episode. You know, Mola di Bari does not have I hate the seven fishes is a false term anyway.
I know you hate that.
We'll call it the fish meal. They make what they call banzarotti, right?
Yeah.
Banzarotti, which is the Barese word. I would call a potato croquette banzarotti, but Italy, different names, same thing. They make like a little cazzone, which is stuffed, which is very typical of, you know, Puglia, Bari, Molfetta, that area. But that was their Christmas Eve.
You know, speaking of your total distaste for the Feast of the Seven Fishes,
nomenclature.
The designation seven fishes. You have talked for, I don't know how many years we've been doing this podcast and how many years before I've known you. You've talked about searching for the Genesis article of this term. And I think I found it and I sent it to you and you didn't even.
Did you really?
You never responded. I don't think
because you
send
me emails. You got to remind. You know, I'm a little starting ahead sometimes.
Yes.
Why would you like flag that for me?
Well, here's what I
of all
up.
The stuff we send each other. Probably the most important article. It's like a footnote.
So here's what I did. I keep in mind, not every newspaper in the world is on newspapers.com, but it's a pretty good archive, and I have a professional level membership to it. I've searched everything they have. I literally read every article where some guy caught seven fish. I mean, just seven fish, my term. So I went as far back as I could to find the first article that mentions it as an Italian feast here in America. And believe it or not,
can I make a guess? And I've never seen it.
Yeah, you have.
I want to gamble on this.
Okay.
Somewhere between 85 and 88.
Earlier. Slightly.
What year?
1978.
Wow.
20th December. Guess what paper? Well, you can't guess what paper. You won't guess what paper, but.
What paper?
It is.
Connecticut.
No, my friend. It is the Courier Post of Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Wednesday, December 20th, 1978.
Wow.
Holiday cooking Italian style.
And you know what I bet? See, I have another theory. So for those of you who don't know, I remember, I never ever heard, right? So I'm born 1975. Let's do the math on this. I never heard of a seven fish, a numerically qualified Italian Christmas Eve. And then I remember it had to be in the mid 80s. It had to be on the Today Show or Good Day New York or something. Someone's talking about the quote unquote Feast of the Seven Fishes. And my grandmother, being superstitious, because Neapolitans are superstitious, says, look, where's this number? Where is this coming from? The seven. I remember us having a discussion. Were we doing something wrong? Where did this seven? We were. I remember it was like a fat, like, who, seven? Like, I know no one had ever heard of that.
I think this may be the beginning.
And someone said something like, well, it's considered unlucky if you don't have seven fishes.
Yeah, I've heard it's considered unlucky if you don't have an odd number of fishes.
And we had never heard of this, but my grandma and mother are superstitious people. That's a God's honest truth. Because I am who I am today because I was into this stuff since I was like a toddler. I remember cleaning shrimp with my grandmother, 4 years old.
Oh, sure.
With a plastic bib on. So that had to be 1979. But my theory is that and I'll say this kindly, Medigan, because some people find that an offensive term, person who was working for a newspaper, wanted to do a holiday story and said, oh, I remember the Italians who lived next door to me used to eat a lot of fish on Christmas Eve, and found somebody. And I bet you there is some little village, some frazione somewhere in the south of Italy that has a numerical tradition, because every town does its own thing. That's Italy. Every little village has its own traditions. And Abruzzo loves numbers with meals. Like at Mount Malin, there's another town in Abruzzo. They do 12 dishes on the Feast of St. Joseph, meatless dishes. The Abruzzes have something with numbers and dishes, sevens and 12s. Mm. And the reason I bring that up is Philly is Abruzzes. Mm. What the Sicilians are to New Orleans is what the Abruzzes are to Philly. And that includes Molise, because when most of these people came here, Molise was still part of Abruzzo until, 1964?
Yeah, something like that.
So that's the dominant culture. So that Cherry Hill makes sense when you say that, because Cherry Hill is right outside Philly. And if there is a village in Italy that has and I bet you it wasn't seven fish dishes. I bet you it was seven dishes. Because if you're in Abruzzo, unless you're on the seacoast, how are you going to get seven different fishes?
Yeah, I can't imagine seven. I mean, especially in Cucina Povera. This, to your point, this article was written by a woman named Carolyn Little. She doesn't intimate that she's Italian. She's sort of covering, you know, the ethnic footprint.
And when I say Medigan, it's not an insult to her.
She's non-Italian.
Because someone's going to email Pat say Medigan. She had no point of reference, right? She remembered the Italian kids. She grew up next in Cherry Hill. They had the Italian grandmother used to make fish on Christmas Eve. She went over because maybe she didn't have a food tradition on Christmas Eve. She interviewed someone in Philly and they say it's seven fishes. And they had to be.
But this is what this sounds like. She interviews this lady, Ida Falcone, and all about her Christmas Eve tradition. And Ida is specific that she makes seven different fish. Maybe this is the nugget of where it came from. I don't know.
In over how many podcast episodes have we done?
250,
whatever they've been. And I wasn't on in the beginning, but there's nothing that enrages me, like the sauce gravy conversation. There's nothing, right? Because to me, it's such a waste. It's a waste of, you know, the world is falling apart and people are worried about it. Do you say so? But I mean, it's entertainment for some people,
right?
But I call it the gravy ethnic cleansing is when whatever cookbook author came up with the word Sunday sauce, right? Now that's become the new word. And it's beating down on gravy, which is a historical term in North Jersey, which, you know, I get very defensive about because it's part of the cultural mosaic of New Jersey and New York. New York's not my headache. That's not my problem. That's your people. But for my people in North Jersey, that's who we are. That's our word. And I feel that some author who try to explain, and this is not a criticism, it's a pedagogical device. They try to explain to someone who didn't understand it was there's this concoction, this tomato sauce with meat in it and macaroni that Italian Americans from the South have on Sundays. And we call it, and they use the word Sunday sauce. So they've educated people, but the expense of the word gravy.
Yeah.
But Anne is like hanging on and she's like, why are these people?
Yeah. We have an Italian American from New York here with us who is a professional in this field. So without further ado, let's bring her on. Annie Petito is from Cooks Illustrated magazine, and she came to our attention through America's Test Kitchen, which Pat was in awe of because she went on and actually tested Struffoli in America's Test Kitchen, a very popular show for those of you who are fans.
She represented us.
Yeah.
And that's why she deserves to be here.
She's part of the Struffoli squad.
Correct. But she's part of our tribe. And she did the right thing.
Annie, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That was quite the introduction. Thank you so much. I was happy to represent.
Yeah, you did a good job.
Thank you so much. That was a very nice introduction.
Well, we're happy to have you on here and thanks for coming on. And how about you? Your family have a set number of fish for Christmas Eve?
So my father's side is Italian, Neapolitan and Sicilian. It's not something that he enjoyed. So in my immediate family, we didn't grow up doing the fishes, but my cousins have been doing it for years. And so it was always seven in their house.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
$10 when you go back, you go to Long Island, right? That was in the article.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Are you going this Christmas?
We won't be going this Christmas. You know, I miss it. I'm hopefully, I have a toddler these days. Lots of little kids running around. So it makes it a little more challenging to get together, but I'm hopeful that my daughter will get to experience the seven fishes and the full out family get together as she gets a little bit older.
When you call your aunt, and I bet you that seven number was a later development.
It's a good question.
I will ask her. Actually, I've always been intrigued by the fishes, especially since growing up, it wasn't something that we did, but I've done, you know, listening to you talk about it, about the numbers, the seven, the 12, is it representative of the sacraments of
it's BS, Anne.
It's I know BS.
It got shoved down our throats. It created
that's not fair.
Havoc.
You don't know it's BS.
Yes, it is BS. I was there in the '80s. I remember us having.
I was there in the '80s.
No, I was there. I swear, God, look at that. I'm not lying to you. Because I'm messed. The reason I'm on this podcast is I was like this as a child, right? There's been many years of whacked outness that brought me to this point, right? And I can remember that conversation. Trying to figure this out. And I think a lot of people adopted it because it gave us structure, right? It gave us structure. But, you know, Gabriella Maletti, a dear friend of ours and a listener, Gabriella changed my whole mind on Christmas Eve because Gabriella's mother's family is from Calabria. They're from what I understand, an interior part of Calabria. And they have macaroni with chickpeas. I think they make lagana, macaroni and chickpeas on Christmas Eve. Mm-hmm. And then they have bacala. And back 100 years ago, if you're in the interior Calabria, that's a pretty good meal. Bacalà is a special treat. And you're far, far away from the ocean. That's the most you're going to get. That's what empowered me and Rosella having the Banzerò tradition to destroy the seven fishes myth. Because I don't want that myth to take away from people's real tradition. So somebody like Gabrielle, now Gabrielle is a professional Italian American, so we don't have to worry about her infringing on her tradition because she knows it better than anybody. But I don't want someone out there who had a tradition from their particular town to feel that it was incorrect because of a later development. Now, they could choose not to do it. They want to add fish. They want to get lobster. God bless America. That's great. But I don't want them to feel that their family tradition is somehow incorrect because they've been misinformed by the seven fish.
That's very fair. That's along the lines of preserving regional languages, really, right? I mean, you know, as everything's standardized. Annie, what was your family tradition then? I mean, obviously, you guys made Struffoli.
We made Struffoli. So for us, getting together at my aunt's house, that was the center of Christmas. In our family, food is a centerpiece. My aunt's a fantastic cook. Lots of arancini.
This struck me also, because I deciphered. I picked through your article.
You did, okay.
Yeah, because I'm a sick person. This is what sick people do. Who's the Sicilian in the family that the arancini showed up?
So my paternal grandmother is from Sicily and my paternal grandfather was from Naples.
So that's the amalgamation.
Yes.
What's your mother's side?
My mother's side was Polish. So she was introduced to all of these things when she joined the family, all these traditions.
But they have their own. She's Polish Catholic?
She was. Yes.
So they have a strong, but they have their own very strong Christmas Eve tradition. which I would say is neck and neck with Southern Italians, with the pierogi and the apłatek. And I grew up with Polish kids, so
the Italian side of the family really took over our traditions. So that really is what won out. So we always celebrated it. We didn't do too many Polish traditions growing up, which is a bummer. But yeah, it was the Italian side that won out.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
You know, after Italian food, I think Polish is my second favorite food.
I love Polish food. Well, I grew up with it. It's like a fallback for me because I grew up surrounded by Polish people.
I can
sing Stolat and the stanzas.
You could talk most like I've heard you speak Bulgarian to people. I don't know how you do it.
John and I were in a camp in Miami with a Bulgarian camp driver. And my 3 years of Russian from college, somehow we had a conversation.
Yeah, the whole time. It was amazing. And the guy didn't speak English either. You guys had a whole conversation.
It was fun.
Only you.
He was like, we almost christened this kid at the end of the conversation. We were like BFFs. We were like on the next plane over.
Yeah, we were very close. You know, you talk about Polish cuisine, and it makes me think of something else I was thinking about as we were doing this. And I don't know about the two of you guys, but I want us to talk about Strufli because this is something I've been thinking about a lot. But my grandmother, who passed on all of her fish recipes, her Christmas fish recipes in particular to me, I never picked up how she made Strufli. And it's not a complicated recipe, but I tried it once the year after she passed, and I made basically like lead sinkers for fishing, and I never tried it again. And I've been buying them ever since at the bakery. But my grandmother and her sisters also used to make at the same time was a cookie that we called Nucatel that I also can't make. And I actually get them oftentimes at Polish bakeries, those like ribbon cookies with the powdered sugar on them. Is that something you guys had?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You too, Annie.
I did. I'm familiar, but they're like they're like fried.
Yeah.
Like a
kruszyki in Polish.
I was going to say the kruszyki. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Do you know what your Italian side called them?
I don't know. When you said that term, I was kind of getting ready to look up what kind of cookie that was. So that's interesting that you had that.
Yeah. But do you know why that is? I'll tell you why that is. Because the leftovers, I say strusel, but my mother and I, today was a very, Annie, you don't understand, this is a big podcast episode for us. I had a conversation, I never in my life had a pre-conversation with my mother on a podcast episode, but this is an intense episode. And a lot of places in the south of Italy, I say strusel, that's my word. I don't know anybody else in my mother's family that uses that, but I'll say maybe strufel for the point of conversation. When they would make the balls, right? So they would fry the balls. And then when they were done frying the balls, they would take the leftover dough and do something different with it. So some people would turn it into kruszyki, kiakira, nukatel, whatever you want to call it, which is like that long ribbony kind of crispy cookie thing. And in the cilento, they made the pasticella from that. And pasticella would be a struffoli dough formed into a ravioli stuffed with chestnut puree. And some people put marmalade in, some people put chocolate in. I mean, different stuff. Some people put pine nuts in, God forbid. I'm deathly allergic, Andy. That's why. You know what? You know, like Superman's kryptonite?
It's true.
And so there's a lot of places that would make one dough. The majority would be strufli. And then there would be a second thing that would be made from the dough that was left. So I think, John, that was a big Salerno thing. I think that's where that came from.
I love them, there's something I miss. I mean, I do, like I said, I get them at the Polish bakery. Sometimes you find them at the Italian bakeries, depending on, you know, how they maintain their older recipes and stuff. But they were really after Strufli, those are my favorite. They were hand in hand.
They're a big Carnevale thing because they were used as spoons for the sanguinache.
Is that right? That makes so much sense.
Yeah.
Wow.
So if you have like two spoons in the house because you're poor.
Yeah.
That's what, for those who don't know. Sanguinache is pig's blood and chocolate cooked together into a pudding.
One of my favorite things in the world.
And who does it good, John?
You do the best. Thank you. You do the best ever. I really mean that.
That's one of my specialties.
That is one of your specialties.
And the gakira, kiakira, nukatel, kruszyki was the spoon. So you would scoop up a little bit and then you would eat the spoon with the chocolate pudding on top. And I guess that's like very environmental when you think about it.
That's very true. That's a very good point.
The Neapolitans are always ahead of the game. I wonder if you could do that with a gelato, because then the spoon is gone. That's
a great point.
And there's no waste. There's no leftover.
See, you might be onto a new business. Like the guy who put the pizza in a cone. Did you ever see that? That horrible concoction?
Well, we came up with the ice cream cone.
What do you mean?
Well, everybody fights what Italian came up with the ice cream cone, but there's unanimity that was an Italian that came up with the ice cream cone.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I wanted to do an episode on this because they say the guy was from Hoboken. He was at the St. Louis World's Fair. I think it was St. Louis and not Chicago. Maybe I'm one. I think it was the St. Louis World's Fair. And he ran out of cups to put ice cream in. And he basically turned the pizza into an ice cream cone.
That makes so much sense.
We're smart people.
Yeah.
That's why we made the Renaissance. We're good at stuff like that. Annie, I am so excited you're here. You represent us on Cooks Illustrated.
Yeah, really.
Oh, thank you.
You carry our flag. It's so important to me that in these major American institutions, and most especially gastronomic institutions, members of our tribe, people who get us, are there to represent and to, I don't want to say protect our interests. That sounds like she works for the CIA. But, you know, look out for the tribe.
Annie, you wrote this article on making and testing Struffoli, and kind of got into some of the history of it. Why don't you share with the audience what you found about the history of these things? Because they're fascinating. I was particularly fascinating around the connection to Greece and the things like that.
Sure. So, and I, you know, Patrick, if there's anything that you disagree with, feel free to jump in. I feel like you probably know, probably maybe a little bit more than I do.
I got a theory when you do the second article, but I'll let you go. Cause you know, unless John mutes me, I don't shut up.
Well, essentially, you know, I think with a lot of dishes, sometimes, you know, the origins can be murky. So trying to find an exact, you know, pinpointing where the, you know, the name comes from, where it first appeared can be kind of tricky. But basically what we found was the connection was to Greece. And so that in Greece, Naples, like I think you were speaking about earlier, Patrick, about being on the water, there's, you know, sailors and ports.
We are Greeks. I mean, Naples comes from the word Neapolis.
Right.
Agropolis. Well, you know, what movie where they say, is it Mediterranean? We're more Greek than we're Italian. I mean, we were speaking Greek until it kind of, even when the Romans occupied us, we spoke Greek at home and Roman in the, you know, Roman for business.
I think the connection makes sense. That basically, you know, and I believe also there is a Greek dessert that are similar. They're a little bit larger than struffoli, but they're these also honey drenched kind of fritters. And, you know, ultimately the word that we found that is the origin is, I think, and I apologize if I butcher this, but strongulos, which essentially means round. And so I think if you, you know, that's the original struffoli, I don't know if that's how you want to say it. And that dish is a leucomedes. And it wasn't until basically entrepreneurial nuns who in the southern part of Italy, I think that's something that's all over the world, that these are kind of hubs of where confections are being created and sold, things like cannoli and sfogliatelle to sustain themselves. And then struffoli in particular became a Christmas gift that, or what we found was given as a Christmas gift to noble families who'd been especially generous during the year.
Wow. How about that? I had no idea about that. That is fascinating. Because I know that oftentimes they would, you know, sell these things like on a regular basis, different, you know, pastiera at Easter time. But I imagine the idea of giving these to noble families is, that's interesting. Because I always think of that when you see them displayed in like a big mound. There is some certain visual nobility to a struffoli. I don't know why, even though it's humble. It always strikes me as something you picture at a ball, you know, this big mound of pastries.
It is very humble. And I, you know, I was thinking about that because, you know, when this recipe was developed, it was for our holiday issue, which is always, you know, a pretty big time of year, obviously. And that's a big issue for us. And we always talk about what's the showpiece dessert going to be. And usually it's, you know, a layer cake or some sort of a trifle. We did a Yule log one year. And so the fact that struffoli kind of got to be the holiday dessert was, I, you know, kind of exciting.
Yeah.
Because I think in a sense, maybe it's not what you might immediately think of as a showpiece, but for our family, you know, even though, like you said, it is humble, it's these little tiny fritters all piled up or in a wreath. But with the candy, the dried fruit, they're just so festive and colorful. And to me, they always were the center of our dessert table on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day.
And when you did this article, right, obviously the whole idea of Cook's Illustrated, I think the difference for Cook's Illustrated as a publication than other sort of, let's say, culinary magazines that you might grab off the rack at the supermarket, there's almost a science behind Cook's Illustrated, right? You guys are all testing this stuff out. It's much more academic, I guess, right, behind these recipes.
Yes, I think that's a good way of putting it. Cook's Illustrated, we really dive deep into the, you know, the hows and whys of something works, which for me, particular for this piece, because it was such a personal recipe, to kind of to look at it in an objective way and, you know, assess my aunt's recipe was kind of interesting, and trying to be neutral about it.
Or at least diplomatic.
Exactly. Yeah. And I, you know, I'll say I still think, you know, I think I ended up with a pretty good recipe, but I'll, you know, I'll say that I love hers more. But we try to really, I think, really examine, you know, why is each ingredient in this recipe? What's its role, the function of it? How, you know, essential is it from a certain standpoint? And so I think in the end, what we try to do is provide recipes that are obviously not only delicious, but you can learn something from them.
And something you did that I found really interesting was you talked about how you prepared the honey, right? Because they're not particularly sweet on their own, the dough, right? You eat a Stroufli without anything on it, it's, you know, bready.
It's bland. I think you can bland, say it's kind of bland. It's okay.
Yeah, a little bit, right?
Can I speak in its defense?
Yeah, go ahead.
No, but I got to speak in its defense. You are taking this from the perspective of someone in 2022 who has a world inundated with sugar, cane sugar.
True. Very true.
Mm-hmm.
So American people loves really sweet stuff, right? That's why we're soda drinkers and not wine drinkers. But if you go back to the Renaissance and pre-Renaissance, pre-sugar Italian desserts, they're mildly sweet.
Right.
They're not overly bearingly sweet.
Yeah.
So the condemnation of putting them in the bland category.
No, but wait a minute.
But it's an indication of a modern palate.
But I'm not saying Stroufli are bland, though. Wait, I'm just saying that the sans any kind of honey or sprinkles. Sure. What's the real word for sprinkles? You use it in the article.
The nonpareils.
Nonpareils. But you make a point that it's sometimes it's hard to get the honey onto these things, right? And there's a billion different kinds of honey. I think honey is, I'm kind of like becoming more and more anthropologically obsessed with honey. Because it's, you know, it's ancient, and that you can, depending on where it's, what plants it's near, the flavor changes, and there's different grades of it. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people don't even know. They go in a supermarket and buy honey flavored corn syrup and think it's honey, which is sad. But you decided to cook them in the honey to get it to stick. That was your method. Is that what your family did, or you just kind of, that was your solution?
No. So my aunt's recipe was you make your little cookie, which I call them a cookie. It was really hard to explain to people on my team, because when I developed these, we were also in the midst of the pandemic. So we were all working from home. So trying to develop a recipe that no one even had like had before and explaining what the texture should be was a little bit of a challenge, but I'll call them a cookie for now. My aunt just warmed the honey and, you know, dropped them in because, you know, she'd been making these for years and years and years. So it's pretty ingrained in her. So I really had to eke out each step and asking her, you know, what does it look like at this stage? What does it feel like at this stage? And try to extract her knowledge so I could take it and, you know, create it into a recipe. And, you know, I think a lot of recipes do that, and that's absolutely fine. For me, and what I wanted was something that had a little more cling, and kind of soaked into the fritters a little bit more, the cookies. And so by letting the fritters spend a little bit of time in the honey and cooking it down, you're evaporating some of the water from the honey. So it really sticks to them a bit better. And I found that it just gave it a little bit more of that like honey flavor on each cookie. And, you know, coming back to before saying bland, I agree with you, Patrick. I think, you know, for our recipes, whenever we develop them, we send them out to a panel of volunteer testers who they make the recipe, they give us feedback. And I think for people in particular who've never had this before, it was kind of a challenge for what exactly they were supposed to be tasting. And a main complaint was that it tasted like honey. Like there was, and like that there's like this cookie and there's this honey and a lot of comments about the flavor. And, but I think you're right. Historically, or, you know, just now we're consuming more sugar. So I understand what you're saying.
You got to send those recipes to our people.
That's right. Yeah.
We have all Italian listeners. We have a tribe.
Sign up to be a taster.
We will. It has to be Italian. Only Italians should taste Italian stuff.
Can you do that?
Oh, sure. Yeah. You can sign up on our website and volunteer and you'll get recipes in your inbox and you can, you know, contribute your feedback. And it's very valuable to us to hear that feedback. And you have to be able to parse out what, you know, it's did people not like the flavor, but they thought it worked?
Yeah.
Or did something go wrong for them? So it, from a development perspective, it's very useful to have that feedback. You just have to kind of weigh what the comments are.
You also said something really interesting in there about if you put the sprinkles on, non-parallels.
Non-parallels. I had to double check before I came.
Okay. I keep wanting to say the non-parallels or so. So
say sprinkles. Everybody knows.
Yeah, sprinkles. I'm
gravy people. I'm sprinkle people. Right. I am who I
Although
am.
Although some people call them Jimmies.
That's I've fine. People, and they say sauce too. We all can all live in peace.
But you made a great point that if you put them on while they're still hot, you end up with sort of multicolored swirls, which I totally, totally understand because you could see who's put them on at the right time. Sometimes they just sort of dissolve into this like galactic mix of colored effect into the honey. But if you get them just right. And you also talked about some people who put candied cucuzza. And I had not even understood that that was a thing until a few episodes back when we had Marian Esposito on, and she said that a lot of Sicilians candy that cucuzza squash, the big long squash. And is that something that you picked up in studying this, or was that something your family did?
That was something my aunt had mentioned to me, like in her just like years of eating the dish, but it wasn't, she always kept hers, I don't want to say plain, but we, you know, vanilla, very like simple. And so for mine, I wanted to, you know, dress it up a little bit more with the candied orange, the nuts. I think it just provides some different textures, some different flavors. So it does kind of like make for a more well-rounded dessert in the end.
My grandmother's sister made them. And when she passed away, the job went to my mother. We always use candied cherries. So it was the sprinkles and the candied cherries, red and green cherries. I mean, we had mounds like we still do. We make a mound of Vesuvius. I mean, you could climb that thing and it was all covered in red and green. But if you go to like Naples, they'll use candied orange peel. They'll use citron. Some towns throw crushed almonds up in it. Some towns throw walnuts in it. It's Italy. Everybody marches to the beat of their own drummer.
Yep.
But you know how I settled the honey issue? Because I ran into the honey issue about 10 or 12 years ago. And Stephanie, the girl who cuts my hair, she also makes them. So when I would get my hair cut, we would also plot and scheme about this, right? How to fix it.
That's truthfully.
Yeah, serious. No, seriously. We're like BFFs on Bastille and stuff like that. We're like on the same brain, right? She's been cutting my hair since she's 17.
Wow.
I have another theory because I spent a lot of time thinking about this stuff. I found that supermarket honey is the problem. And I think what happens is the major brand supermarket honeys are treated, I don't know how they're treated, so that they don't congeal. Because if you have natural honey that comes from the farm, it'll turn into a brick after a while. It just gets into like a big solid mass. But if you get honey from a farm, like a beekeeper, and that's what I do from now on, and I always get it for Stephanie, I always get it for her and for me. When you heat the honey from a beekeeper, from a farm stand honey, that honey performs like a thoroughbred. And it thickens. So when you warm it up, it thickens. And then when you throw the Struffel in, you get the same reaction that your great-grandmother got back in 1922. Mm. So I think that a lot of people, they go and they get the supermarket honey, they throw it on. And I think that there's something, and I don't know if it's a chemical or a treatment that the manufacturer put in to make sure that that honey never congeals, which works against it.
It's a good point.
Interesting.
Yeah. You know, think about that. It's like people who make Neapolitan pizza at their house and then they go out and get the 00 extra fine Neapolitan flour and it changes everything for them, right? Like you don't think about the fact that ingredients are not the same over geography, they're not the same over time, they're not the same over, you know, conditions. So it does make a big difference.
It's a great reason to support your local beekeeper.
Yeah,
absolutely true. And once you have that kind of honey, it's hard to go back to anything else.
I make love to my honey. I know that sounds terrible. I got a honey guy in New York that makes honey. I get his jars of it. Now they're charging like it's like gold.
Everything is now.
I mean, now they're out of control. I mean, they're giving prices. Like, I'm like, come on. I think I got to find a new lover. I'm looking for a new honey to love. Because no, I'm like, come on. You're not. You're
a
not
new honey pusher.
Yeah. I think I got one. I'm kind of eyeing up. We'll see how it works out. I don't want to tell them I'm into them because, you know, once they know you're done. But because I buy a lot of honey. But I mean, some of these have now just gone, you know, they've gone through the roof.
Annie, you said something interesting in introducing this idea to your team at Cooks Illustrated and as the, you know, showstopper Christmas dessert. And you said a lot of people hadn't heard of it. Were you surprised by that? Not surprised. Like, I feel like maybe I live in a fishbowl and most people I interact with both personally and professionally happen to be Italian Americans, but I feel like it's sort of become a little bit more known out there, but it seems maybe not. Did you meet a lot of blank stares?
I did. I was kind of surprised. I mean, as a kid, I remember, you know, after the holiday break, talking to friends about how your holidays were. And, you know, my friends had no idea what I was talking about when I would talk about Struffoli. And so I think I had always kind of been used to people not knowing, but my coworkers who, you know, they've all been in the food industry for a long time. They all have wonderful palates and have eaten all kinds of food. So I think I was a little bit surprised at the lack of experience that they'd had with it, but everyone was super enthusiastic, which was great, and really excited for it and excited to try it. And like I said, during the I was developing this at home during the pandemic. So our editor-in-chief, Dan Suze, and I lived pretty close together. So he was driving over on a daily basis to come pick up samples of Struffoli so he could give me some feedback on them. And we do tastings outside on the steps. And so it was nice because he, you know, he really wanted to try them and understand what they were like. And it was nice to have a coworker at that time period who could like eat them and we could talk about what I was making.
Yeah. I find it so interesting because we, in our online store, italianpower.com, our Italian Power store, where we sell drop printed t-shirts and merchandise, mugs and bags and stuff, 99% of the designs I do. And the first year we had it open, I said, you know, I think people would really appreciate some Christmas stuff. And I started going through my kind of memory bank of concepts and touchstones that were important to me on Christmas and trying to create designs that attached to different ones of them. So obviously the seven fish and this and that. And I started trying to experiment with the idea of Struffoli graphically. We came up with our Struffoli Squad shirt, which inspires the name of this episode. And the response we got was incredible. And it sells, you know, people buy it for the whole family. And I met a guy we were just talking about traditions, and he said his family does Struffoli in such large batches now that all the families around them and compadre and friends that no longer make it, they come and do it together like a club. And it's amazing to me how much of a touchstone it's become. So I guess maybe it is sort of, you know, very identifiable to Italian Americans from a lot of different backgrounds in all different parts of the country, from different backgrounds in Italy, but maybe I guess it still stayed in tribe. It's still, so I'm very impressed that you shared it with the rest of the country and the world. So that's a great service.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a really nice response that we got from it. And, you know, people when the recipe was published, we got a few comments. One particular that always stands out to me is just someone wrote, "I can't believe I'm seeing this recipe in Cooks Illustrated." And I just like,
Why would they say that?
I think it's a very niche kind of, even, you know, I don't know that all Italian Americans, like, I don't know that everyone would know automatically what Struffoli was. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
But I think it has enough of I'm always about our position in the general American mosaic of culture. And if you take the high ground that we had in the 50s and 60s with Dean Martin and Topo Chico and all the other things, we were a represented distinct ethnic group in the United States with a distinct culture and with a distinct traditions and the like. And I feel that we're losing ground because we're being written off in a sense. And I feel that it's so important. And that's why I'm such a champion of what you did, because yes, I mean, there's certain Sicilian things that are not going to be my traditional Calabrese or something else, but I think there's enough of us that we need to be represented in things like general American cookbooks and things like Cooks Illustrated, Because, I mean, number one, we did revolutionize American food as a people when we came in here, right? I mean, things like, you know, pizza and lemon ice and stuff like that, that's generally now taken to be American food, came on our backs when we came here, right? So even if we do have niche products, it's part of the greater Italian-American amalgamated food tradition here that it does deserve its seat at the table. And that's my big thing, like the drum I'm constantly beating is, we need to be, because I think that in an amalgamated culture like the United States, if it's not reflected on Instagram or in Cooks Illustrated or on a cooking show, we're going to unjustly lose our place, and our kids don't get the message that their traditions have equal values with everyone else's. So when your kid is rushing home to make, and I'm not disparaging the candy cane cookie, but when your kid wants to go home and make the candy cane cookie, they're not seeing, in my opinion, in the general discussion, the Italian-American thing that belongs to them. Like, and now you're really going to put me in the lunatic category? I know you did it earlier, and I don't blame you. Everybody else does, Annie. You're not the first. You're not going to be the last. Like, we need, like, John is working on Dominic the Donkey paraphernalia. Because, you know, there's Charlie Brown's Christmas, mm-hmm. and there's Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. And then who's the guy who melted? Frosty the Snowman, right? And I want a Dominic the Donkey cartoon because Italian-American kids should see their place at the table. And in that Dominic the Donkey cartoon, there should be Stroofly on the table.
Well said.
There should be a cookbook. There was a great, you know what we have to get you, Annie? There is a Seven Fishes cookbook that was done by the Italian community of West Virginia. West Virginia has a huge, strong calabrese community. They even have a Seven Fishes festival.
Oh, wow.
And I was so proud because they made a children. Is it a children's book, John?
It's a comic book.
It's a comic book. And I'm like, this is where we need to be. We need to put comic books that celebrate our culture into the hands of our children so that they realize that their traditions are just as worthy as everybody else's. And I think that's why it's so important that everybody should get a shot at Cooks Illustrated, even maybe something that's a niche thing. But, you know, we represented and we were there. We're going to keep marching on, Andy. We're going to keep getting more of our stuff in that magazine.
No, I agree with you. I mean, I was going to say, I credit, you know, my team for being enthusiastic and wanting to share it. Like, I think they recognized how, you know, this was important to me. I think I felt like there would be an audience for it and they supported that. And I think one of the things that was, I thought was very touching was, you know, I interviewed a couple of people for the story, one of them being Jack Bishop, who's our chief creative officer, and he, talking to him about the dish, he hadn't thought of it in years, and it was really something that brought back memories for people as I was talking to them about it, and just that connection between family and the holidays, and Jack talking about making them with his grandmother and the smell of honey in the kitchen. It just, it was really nice that it evoked so much emotion from people. And I think that was what was so important to me about getting to write the story, was that I got to bring my family into the magazine. And I think what I meant earlier by people being surprised by the recipe, I think of so many other Italian desserts that get so much love. And so to me, Struffoli, it's, you know, it's these funny little fritters and, you know, they are kind of like a cookie, but they're fried and they've got honey and candy. And like, what are these wonderful snacky kind of things?
If you know where my theory is, what they've evolved from, the Greeks, yes, the Greek Leucomedes, I think you mentioned. They also, but when the Greeks celebrate 40 days after death, they make and I think Bastia is also involved in this, they boil grain. And the Ukrainians do this on Christmas Eve. A lot of people who are Byzantine, connected with Constantinople and the Greeks, have a religious dish for special religious occasions of boiled grain. And if you think of the Struffoli, it looks like a boiled grain, right? An unhulled piece of wheat. And they mix it with honey and candied fruits. Sometimes they put pomegranate in. Sometimes they put nuts in. And if you take out the Struffoli as a fried dough ball and you put in soaked, cooked grain, which looks like a very small dimensional Struffoli ball, it's the exact same recipe. Mm. It's honey, candied fruit, sometimes nuts. And I think that the Parthenopeans, right, the Greeks that settled Naples, I think at one point there was a switch out from grain to these little balls. Mm. Now, maybe because it spread it more, But if you see that with the Ukrainian, now the Ukrainians eat that on Christmas Eve. The Ukrainians have like this 12 traditional dish meal. And at the end of it is boiled grain mixed with honey and candied fruits and the like. I think that is the prototype. What's the word?
Progenitor.
I think we should all take a trip to Greece, eat all the way through Greece and find it. It's in some village somewhere.
You're right. It's probably there.
Yeah, it's there. Yeah. Then we're going to go to National Geographic. That'll be the next magazine.
I was reading an article in, I don't know, the New York Times or something about the Ukrainian, obviously right now, you know, invaded and war-torn, and how much the Christmas traditions are being preserved over this particularly daunting holiday for them. And they were talking about, yeah, this wheat porridge, same recipe. I would say kucha from like the Sicilian use of it, right?
Yes, kucha. I didn't even think of that, John.
Yeah.
The Sicilians keep it the way it was in Greece. That's a great point.
They make it Saint...
Saint Lucy.
Saint Lucy's Day, right, for Catania. No, Saint Lucy's not Catania. She's what?
Siracusa.
But my radar went off when I read this, and I thought to myself, that's Sicilian. And all of this transference is so absolutely timeless. And I think that, you know, you talk about Cook's Illustrated being a publication of record culinarily in the United States. And yeah, it means something when you bring something of ours into it, and it perhaps transfers yet again. And in generations from here, somebody who has read this and picked it up and made it a part of their family holiday may have no Italian DNA, but it becomes a part of their tradition. And I think that's the beauty of the country. Annie, speaking to that point, is there any other recipe that you have from your family, from your upbringing, that you would like to, in the future, share with the readership of your publication? It doesn't have to be Christmas, just anything that you really identify with. Like, what would be your next, if you could share yet another one of our touchstones, what would it be?
I've always, if I could do another recipe, you know, for my family, I would love to do my grandmother's rice balls.
Mm.
I don't know that we've ever covered that. That's a dish that has been a staple in, you know, all of our family holidays. It's part of our Thanksgiving. It's part of our Christmas. It's part of our Easter. I haven't delved into the history of arancini, so I'm not familiar on, you know, the exact times when it's eaten, but that's something that has always been, it was a dish that I was always really excited to share with friends who came to spend holidays with us. And I would love to tackle that at some point.
Are you guys meat and cheese family? What do you put inside?
So my grandmother would do a meat sauce inside, since she passed. My dad took it over and we streamlined it a little bit. So it was just rice and cheese. My brother has since taken it over. He's interested in adding some peas and, you know, so everyone's kind of changing it up, you know, depending on the cook, which is fun. New traditions.
I like that about arancini, actually. I was in Sicily this year with our other co-host, Dolores, this summer filming a project, and we went to her husband's ancestral island of Alicudi, which is about as remote as one can get, I think.
Doesn't that sound like a disease, Alicudi? I mean, I don't want to insult them. Like, he suffered from Alicudi.
I think it sounds like a fish. I bought 6 pounds of Alicudi.
Yeah, 6 pounds of Alicudi.
But we got there, and it's so small. There's like 3 restaurants, and 2 of them weren't open. When we got them, we were starving. So we went to this like bar, and they said, well, we don't have any food prepped, but you know, you could have a beer, and you could have a granita, whatever. And then the guy took a liking to us. He found out that Drew's family's from Alicudi, so he brought out, they had sequestered some of the arancini from the morning, and he said, look, you could have these. And so we cracked into them. You know, you buy them a street food, you're always used to like the peas, the meat, or sometimes ham, whatever. And these had a seafood mix in them, and it was delicious. And I thought to myself, this is the beauty of the rice ball. It can take whatever's local, because here we are on this island, the middle of the Aeolian. And it's a great package for it. So that would be a wonderful concept to share for sure.
Yeah, I think that would be fun. Like you said, it's pretty customizable, and you know, depending on the size, a little treat, maybe a little something more substantial. So I think that would be really fun.
They're kind of like, if I understand the history of the arancini, and you know, we could put you in touch with Lou Mendola, the foremost Sicilian American authority on Sicily. He moved there.
He is the arch Sicilian. Yeah, that's the name. He is an arch Sicilian.
He is. He knows everything that ever happened in Sicily.
Oh,
so, like,
gosh.
If a king broke a toenail in 1830, he's like, oh, he had Lou's amazing. And he's obsessed with Arancini, actually. So he'd be a great guy for you to speak to. But in talking to him about them, sometimes I think of they're kind of like our Sicilian equivalent of like Cornish pasties are to the Brits, like this meal on the go in its own package, right? That's, I think that's kind of something that I like about that. I think it's, you know, it encapsulates everything and it's portable and it's very flexible. So that's a good choice.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, this has been a lot of fun for us. I hope you'll come back at any time. We'd always love to speak to you about anything you're thinking about around our community and the recipes that make us who we are. So really, thanks so much.
Annie, we stand behind you. There's like 18 to 26 million Italian Americans, depending on who's doing the counting. And every single solitary one of us stands behind you. Because you and the other gentleman, I mean, are there other Italian Americans that are on the staff of Cooks Illustrated?
There are, yes.
Let them know that they represent every single solitary one of us. And it's so important, the work that you do, because you are the New York Times of gastronomy.
True.
You are the paper of record, and you stand there and you represent us and you give a credence to the fact that we have a gastronomic culture as Italian Americans that's shareable with an entire country through your magazine. And I want to send out this invitation. I know John will concur. When you do the arancini recipe, I want all you guys to come on. We actually do a video series. We've had a successful video series.
Oh, wow. Thank you. That's really nice.
We'd come up Vermont, New Hampshire. Where are you, Vermont?
I'm in New Hampshire.
I get very scared when I leave North. When I pass the cat, pass the Catskills, I get very panicked.
Animals
are going
to
eat me. Bears are going to eat me. But we'll do a road trip. But we will definitely have you guys all on to celebrate the arancini. We appreciate you gave deference to your Neapolitan side. So it's fine. You can do the Sicilian side now. That's okay.
You got approval.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And if you ever have any recipe suggestions that I should tackle next, please feel free. I'd love to hear what you guys think we should be.
You're going to regret those words.
Yes, you are. You remember I said in the beginning, if you want me to edit anything out, I can't edit out the conversation.
Take that back. Okay.
No, too late now.
Pat did invent his own pie, by the way, and it's very, very good.
It did.
Oh, send it along. I'd love to.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'd be honored to. Italian American inspired pie.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been amazing. And have a very, very buon Natale, you and your whole family up there. And we hope we see you again.
Thank you so much. You as well. I hope you guys have a nice Christmas.
John, I have the kazoo. What should I sign off with?
Well, it's a Neapolitan Christmas. We're talking about Neapolitan Christmas. So,
Movene Natale. How about Movene Natale?
Movene Natale. If you could pull that off on kazoo, let me say to everybody first, we hope you guys have enjoyed this. We hope you will go out. We're going to link Annie's amazing article on the show page. So if you do not have a family recipe, or you, like me, can't pull off the family recipe, I am going to tell you guys right now, I'm going to be trying it off of Annie's very, very well-tested recipe this year. So hopefully I'll have some photos to share of how mine come out based on this well-researched take on the humble struffoli, a plate that means so much to all of us. So hope everybody out there gives it a shot, or you have the ones that you and your family are making, as long as, no matter what, you're having a very, very buon Natale. From all of us, the Italian American Podcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next year. That's a lot of momentum.
Mamma, mamma, e dammi una mano. Caro rimane fornisce la semana e non sa che fa. Mo' bene Natale.